now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello there, Dean Haglund.
Hello there, Phil Lairness. How are you, sir?
Well, I was excited to get to talk about all manner of fun stuff, but I guess we would be remiss if we did not at least touch on the events in Orlando, Florida of Saturday night.
Right? Again?
Again.
Mass shooting?
Yeah, well, the largest, as they're calling it, the largest terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11. So at least we're setting records.
Right. Not the records we want to set.
No, everyone's going to weigh in on this. There's going to be so much punditry we don't need to add to it, especially in a time when we're still counting the dead. I will say that we just recorded a rather fascinating conversation with a storyteller from Great Britain, Dave Pickering, a show that will come up in the next couple few weeks. And boy, didn't he have a perspective that was refreshing.
Absolutely, and enlightening. One that can sort of show a way forward out of this.
Yeah, so although we're kind of at a loss to say anything right now, rest assured, yeah, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour will have hopefully some inspiring and helpful commentary, though not from either me or Dean, but from a guest we were happy to talk to, and that'll be in a couple weeks' time.
Absolutely.
Turning to happier topics, if what I read is true, and how could it not be? You, Dean Haglund, yes, you interviewed Chris Carter on television there in Sydney, Australia?
Isn't that something? I get an email from my old pals at Studio 10, that morning show that apparently nobody watches because it's 3 hours of how to place food in your fridge, internet gaggle. And, you know, it's some lovely presenters, as they're known here, television presenters, on a panel, including some famous journalist types. And they have always a fifth seat for a fifth guest host. And it rotates every day for 5 days a week. It's sort of a different person in there. And every now and then I get a call to come in and guest host, normally when someone else drops off because I'm very close to the studio. Anyway, so this time I get an email from the producer going, hey, we got Chris Carter live via satellite from LA. He's selling the six episode revival, now available on Blu-ray. And so why don't you come in and sit down with the gang as we, chat with him over the old satellite feed there. And of course, they had written up questions for me, but I'm going, come on, I know the guy and I know what I want to ask. And so, I put the squeeze on him and, it, may or may not have had the effects that I wanted.
What did you hit him with?
Well, I asked him specifically about the Lone Gunman, and I squeezed him on, you know, we were at San Diego Comic-Con 4 years ago now, and I said, the IDW X-Files Season 10 comic book, I said, is that official canon, and that we were alive. Now, what's the situation? And he goes, well, you're alive in the comic books, and you're dead on TV. Like, ow! holy crap, that is that Chris Carter honesty that you come to love. And
because he did say in San Diego that it was canon.
Well, yeah, but I don't know if he retracted that canon statement.
He did. He backed away from it, but
right. So this is one of those instances where, like Schrodinger's cat, the gunmen are alive and dead at the same time.
That actually would be a funny, I don't know, meme, because you could show the photo from the comic books and the photo from the revival, and
exactly, and we're alive and dead at the same time. So that was fun, and then you know, it's a 3-hour show. I recommend people watch it when I'm on. It's got a small, I mean, it's considered number 3 in the morning shows. So there's every network has a morning show here, and they all fight for supremacy of some sort. And this show pays for its high quality staff by doing mini infomercials hosted by Jonathan Coleman, a British DJ guy who also does these segues into, and now we're going to talk about this fitness machine or that makeup product. And then it's like a little 2-minute in-studio infomercial. So I know that people have trouble sitting through that because it's how we pay for the show.
And of course, this explanation was brought to you by... No, I'm sorry. I got nothing.
And now we go to the shake weight. Oh, yeah, no.
I feel like it maybe is... It's sad for you, but better for the gunman to be alive in the comic book world. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it? I mean, I think it's good to know, but then, of course, I pitched him. I said, I got 2 words for you, clone gunman. He said, that's a great idea. And so perhaps he's going to run with that thought in the upcoming sci-fi universe. But
and, yeah, of course, isn't there a graphic novel where they may, in fact, be alive? I don't know.
Absolutely, and at my current rate of production, it should come out at the same time if he puts that in the new series, which is also what he said. He said that everybody loved the Six revival, that the studio's into it, that David and Jillian are into it, he's into it. Everybody seems to be into it. It's just a matter of now scheduling and making it happen. Jillian's getting quite a lot of success in her police procedural show, The After, is it called? I'm not watching it.
The Fall.
The Fall, yeah. That one. And so I'm not sure what kind of contract she
No, the last season, the last season is almost done. And of course, Duchovny's doing Aquarius, and they're both very busy, but they'll get the schedules worked out, not for this next year, but for the year after that.
Yeah.
You know, or as I like to call it, year 11 of your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. anyway, or year 12 actually is what it would be by then. But I was told there'd be no math. Anyway, from the massacre in Orlando to the fictional death of 3 beloved computer programmer hackers to celebrity deaths.
Oh, right.
Celebrity deaths.
One of the truly great playwrights died this past week. Sir Peter Schaeffer.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the English playwright and screenwriter who scored an Oscar for Amadeus and an Oscar nomination for the adaptation he did of his own play Equus. That is one of my favorite plays.
Both of those are, epic.
He died in Cork County, Ireland, County Cork, Ireland. He was 90 years old.
Wow.
Wrote, this is interesting to find out that he wrote at least 18 plays. What does that mean? Are there some they're not sure about? I mean, that sounds very like who wrote Shakespeare's plays? But in addition to Amadeus and Equus, you have The Royal Hunt of the Sun, which was produced by UK's National Theatre Company in 1964.
Wow.
It was the first show produced by the National Theatre Company, by the way. So how about that? You're the first produced playwright by the National Theatre Company. So your career spans everything that the Nash has done. And the cast of his next work, the 1965 black comedy, featured, get this, Maggie Smith, Derek Jacobi, and Albert Finney. That's the cast in that man's second play.
Wow. That's some powerhouse talent right there. What was that play called, the second one?
Black comedy.
Oh, it is black comedy. Oh, I don't think I've ever seen that or read that. It's weird.
Kind of makes you want to read it, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Amadeus, of course, won his adaptation, which was made into the big screen film.
Yeah,
won
holy
eight
smokes.
Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor. Equus debuted on the West End in 1973, moved mm-hmm. to Broadway the following year, winning the Tony Award for Best Play.
And think about the inspiration on that, too. That was a horrible story of a kid killing his horse. He had read that in the paper, and that was the inspiration to write this epic, basically a one-man show written from the boy with nudity. And this whole man, a whole lot of really, for an actor, Equus is sort of the modern-day Hamlet.
Oh, that's a very interesting. I'd never thought of that, but that strikes a real chord with me. Yeah, as to why I love it so much. So anyway, Peter Schaefer, several of his other plays made into movies. I mean, it feels like, you know, they don't make them like Peter Schaefer anymore.
They don't.
And indeed, you know, you're talking about someone who he worked with and when he began, it is his life was the history of modern theater.
Yeah.
So Dean, what are you reading these days? That's what I want to know. And of course, what we're reading is brought to you by Booksmith Used Books in Nelson, British Columbia, fine purveyor of used books and all things literary.
Well, you know, we've been reading the high tomes of biographies and that sort of thing. But recently, a stack of comic books unique to Australia about The Phantom. This is a 1940s classic that was revived. It was sort of just printed here by a gung-ho tiny publisher, Jim Shepherd. And he put out these comic books, roughly printed. And then, oddly enough, he sold it off, and it became huge in Sweden. And Sweden said, hey, do you mind if we draw and write some more? And then so now Sweden's like co-producing with Australia this comic book series that's still for sale in pharmacies and drugstores all across this country. And it is fascinating. Believe it or not. I mean, it's a bit cheese, but it sort of gives you a bit of insight into the culture and the world of Australian comic book dumb.
Now, is this the same The Phantom that was made into the movie starring Billy Zane and Patrick McGoohan?
No, that's the weird thing. That was sort of a radio drama. So this seems to be a variant on it, but this guy's dressed in purple and has a little mask on his eyes and is completely different than Phantom.
But the Phantom, played by Billy Zane, was dressed in purple.
Well, then it maybe is the same, because Billy Zane's from here. So, yeah, I think it is probably the same.
So we just went from no, that's the weird thing, to yeah, I think it probably is. All on the basis of the color of the costume.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very unique costume.
Well, but you'll need to look into this to tell me next week whether indeed this was responsible for the legendary blockbuster that was The Phantom.
Was it a legendary blockbuster? I don't think it was.
I remember talking to Patrick about this, Patrick McGoohan, about the Phantom, and wondering, you know, like, of all, he's so choosy in his later life, why did he do this? And he said, well, I thought it was directed by the man who directed Lonesome Dove. And I said, well, it was. It was directed by the man who directed Lonesome Dove. He said, no, 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 no. I learned very quickly on location that Robert Duvall must have directed Lonesome Dove.
Why did he think, what?
Because the director of Lonesome Dove directed The Phantom, but realizing how shitty a director this guy was on the set of The Phantom, he realized that Robert Duvall must have been in charge of that thing.
Very good.
See? Or yeah. See. My friend Radmar played a significant role, kind of the Alfred, the manservant to The Phantom, in the movie version, and he was getting all sorts of kind of what would you call it, contradictory direction, right, in his performance. And
oh, no.
And he said it was just, he was miserable, he was suffering, and all of a sudden the burden was lifted because he senses someone moving past him. He can't quite see who it is, but he recognizes the voice as McGoohan's. And McGoohan says, I just came by to tell you you're doing everything excellently. Ignore the buffoon. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was great. Anyway, I don't know. I was kind of, I don't know whose impersonation I was doing there, but still it sent chills, didn't it?
Yeah, sure did.
I just started reading a book that I'm really excited about, especially in the wake of seeing Sully's documentary, the documentary that Sully produced, Sully McCullough, called Dying Laughing, about comedians. I'm reading The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy by Cliff Nesteroff. And I'm only a few pages in, but this thing's a page-turner.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, really charting how, although at any point in comedy's history, if you go back two generations, the fans of that contemporary comedy won't be able to recognize what's funny two generations earlier, but really charting how each generation influences the next generation. So you really can appreciate the lineage.
Yeah. That's true, isn't it? Because I've been listening to old Goon shows with Peter Sellers, and you can see the lineage from that to Monty Python to the, you know, all the way to Mighty Boosh kind of thing. And it's fascinating, but I'm listening to it with a thoughtful squint and nodding my head at the jokes, not killing myself laughing and doubled over.
Right, right. Well, I would say that the lineage probably goes from the Goon Show to Monty Python to Saturday Night Live and SCTV.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that was big influence, I know, on Saturday Night Live, Monty Python and the Goon Show.
Yeah.
So anyway, I can't wait to read this and to share with you any kind of findings that I have. But I love the cover. The cover is kind of a mock-up of sort of the thing that was done on Sgt. Pepper's album. You know, all the historic figures in a wax museum kind of a thing. And right. Who they choose, it's quite an assemblage. So anyway, a lot of fun. We heard from the proprietor of Booksmith Used Books this week. Gentlemen, thanks again for mentioning Booksmith on your very fine podcast. As a thank you, I'd like to offer your listeners a 20% discount on their next purchase.
Oh.
All they have to do is mention Chill Pack Hollywood Hour when they get to the till. But this is for actual listeners only, so let's not go posting this on social media, okay?
Good point.
So if you're in Nelson, British Columbia, stop by Booksmith Used Books and mention your good friends at Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and get a 20% discount. I'd also like to reply to a comment Phil made on last week's show. It was something David Lynch said about the criticism that hurts the most is when your heart isn't in the work being criticized. It has been right. My experience that compliments on work my heart wasn't in hurt just as much, if not more, than the criticisms.
Oh.
Whenever I do work I don't believe in, I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, and I can't put my whole heart and soul into it. And that makes me a fraud. If someone tells me they enjoyed it or found meaning in what I did, I do not deserve that praise because at best I was mediocre. There was never any hope that you were going to get my best work, and that's not fair. I will say in my own defense, the last time I did work I didn't believe in was nearly 30 years ago. But you know, thanks again for your work. You always bring something worth pondering. Stephen D. Fowler and the Smoke and All-Stars, Booksmith quality used books. You know, performers, I think, deal with this a lot, and
absolutely.
They deal with it to a varying degree of grace, right? If you're in a play and you feel like you really were off that night, it can't be an easy thing to get the adulation of the audience then when they come back and tell you how wonderful it was or whatever. You know, you kind of want to say, right, well, you should have seen it last night. Last night was good. Tonight was bad. But that's not graceful. You're denying them the experience that they had. You're taking a smile off someone's face, and that's no way to live. You and I have talked about this before. You never know when the person in front of you is someone who liked the thing, because no matter how bad it was, there will be people who loved it, and no matter how great it was, there will be people who hated it. So
absolutely, because it's a personal interpretation through our own filters.
But I do have a lot of... I've witnessed some horror stories that bear out the truth of what he's saying, though. Where
recently?
Recent enough. I don't. If someone is that way, I tend not to want to associate with them. But I have witnessed it, and I have stories of people being really crestfallen when someone didn't appreciate the right thing. According to the artist, right?
Right.
I've always thought, it's why I always say, like, when we are celebrating people in celebrity deaths, we try to take some time. We didn't with Mr. Schaefer, really, but, try to express something that maybe were works that that the larger fan base didn't know about. Because no matter how much you love someone's work, there's almost always more to discover.
Right.
And maybe those other works were things that were more personal to the artist that you consider yourself a fan of.
Well, and go back to Amadeus by Peter Schaefer, as we talked about celebrity. Think about the story of that. That's a story of another composer who's in a mental institution because God forsaked him by putting talent into this wretched, ribald Mozart, and he is now the patron saint of mediocrity. That's his cry through the halls of the asylum. That's how the whole story of the biography of Amadeus is painted out. And so you go, other composers, you compare yourself left and right and drive yourself nuts going, this isn't my best work. I think about that play and that movie a lot, particularly when I feel I've done something that is, not as I envisioned it in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. Ask you. I don't think you do, but let me ask you this, because this is what I've been thinking about. Does it ever get under your skin? Not that you would admit, but does it ever get under your skin how people's first thing with you is always seems to be the X-Files, and no matter where you are, even if you're at something that's a gallery showing or something like that, does it ever, I'll just leave it at that. In any way, does that ever get under your skin?
No, because, I always said from like second year of the show, what a great business card this is. This is, your way in. And I knew, you got a lot of other talents. You got your improv and your stuff, and people may or may not know about it. So how handy is it to have a internationally renowned TV show of that quality you know, if I was known for, you know, Gossip Girls or whatever, Earth 2, you know, some other shit show, then I would be like, that would get under my skin. But the fact that it's X-Files, it has legs, as we say in the business, and it's a gift that keeps on giving. I never, it never makes me go and grumble to myself.
That also has to be, and I get what you're saying about the quality of it playing a big part. It also has to have to do, I would think, with you never buying in that this was your relevancy. It might be your calling card. It might be a bigger spotlight, but it's not what makes you relevant as a human being, that you have a wide range of gifts to explore.
And as luckily my training was such, it's that who you are is not what you do. So it's easy to go, oh, yes, I'm known for doing this, but I know it's not who I am. So it's not defining me in any way. Therefore, it never gets under my skin because it's not the be-all and end-all definition.
Except podcasting. Podcasting is what you do. And it's what you are. And it's what you are.
Right. Except as soon as I open my mouth, then you realize I'm not that.
I didn't put this in here, but I am going to, we're talking about comedy, we're talking about these things. I'm going to throw in a live event of the week, Dean Haglund.
Oh.
Look at me go.
Look at you go.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Mark Hirschhorn was in town.
Was he? Succotash?
Yeah, the comedy podcaster who's internationally recognized as such, Mark Hirschhorn of Succotash. He was in town for a variety of reasons, really hush-hush clandestine meetings. He also taught improv to my acting intensive students this weekend.
Oh.
And I had him do it to them in character. They were not doing the improv. Their characters that they were exploring all weekend long were doing the improv. So that added another level to what he teaches, which was great, great fun. And it was so kind of him to come and do it. And I think he got a kick out of it. But his main reason, the impetus behind coming down, was to produce the first episode of the Carvey podcast. And this is a new podcast that recorded for the first time this weekend at the Improv Lab, where we were invited to do a show the last time you were in town.
Right.
And Dana Carvey apparently picked up the invitation that we put down, and he was there recording his first ever podcast along with his sons, who star on the podcast. And so that's what we did. It was great fun. Always fun to be hanging out with Mark Hirschhorn. Dana Carvey is so funny. This guy has so much to offer, Dean. It's unbelievable. And sadly, he took a header off the stage during the show.
No, he did not.
He did.
How bad?
It was bad. Oh. It was bad. It was a barrel roll.
Good Lord. Face plant into the crowd?
No, off to the side. He didn't know that the stage didn't extend. So he was stepping off to create a little more room and then stepped off. And, you know, there was a welt raised on the side of his head. I mean, I think he had a concussion. He did the rest of the show with a concussion. Not like you and I. Look, and this is what I told him. After, you know, you get to 9 years of a weekly show and you can't count on one hand anymore how many times you've done the show with a concussion.
Of course, you can't
count it on one hand because you probably still are feeling the effects of the last concussion.
Well, yeah, that's my warm-up now. I give myself a concussion.
But he had a greatest line. He's 61 years old, and when asked if he was okay when he returned to the stage, he said, look, it's really recommended for a man my age to take as many falls as he can.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever recommended, frankly. Yeah.
I think that was the concussion talking. Anyway, that was my live event of the week. Dean, I saw this movie that we talked about a while ago that I was cautiously optimistic about because I'd heard good things. The full trailer was good. but I'd been worried because the commercials had been awful. And that is the 1970s tongue-in-cheek detective movie written and directed by Shane Black, The Nice Guys, starring Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe.
Right. Now, this is curious because someone here just saw it and talked about it yesterday. And they're not a movie aficionado, but they enjoy movies. And I want to hear your take.
I really enjoyed this a lot. I mean, it's another case like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang where this guy nails it, works in a genre that he loves, but in a genre that I realized as popular as the detective genre was for so long, there's not a wide appeal for this anymore. And it boils down to this for me. In any one of these, whether it's tongue-in-cheek or not, the audience has to pay attention. Because you can get lost quickly.
Yeah.
And if you're not paying attention, then, well, honestly, the comedy probably doesn't work too well either. Right?
Right.
So, it's because it's fascinating. Great reviews and lackluster box office. But the people who see it seem, to the most part, to be enjoying it.
Oh, okay. So you're saying only people with attention spans are seeing this, or?
Well, I don't think there's any appeal in this genre. I don't think in the detective genre anymore there's appeal for young people. And we'll talk about, actually, whether films have any appeal for young people in a little bit when I weigh on another one. But I do think, yeah, detective genre is really, really tough. I remember when, oh God, what was it? Could it have been L.A. Confidential? Maybe. Which, of course, got embraced by the critics, got embraced by all the awards groups. But think about it. This was not a hit. This one didn't make any money. L.A. Confidential, right, was not a hit. How much action and excitement and suspense is there in that? But the complaint was it was too hard to follow. If that movie was hard to follow, what would someone make of The Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep Out of the Past?
All of those film noir, DOA, for crying out loud.
Today, yeah. What would they make of it today?
Yeah. Wow. So, because this was the what he said was, characters are great. LA looks great in the 70s. You know, how it's recreated with the smog coming down as a black gloom. But that the actual caper, the actual story that they were doing wasn't that great. That's what he thought.
About halfway through, it loses some of momentum in terms of the plot. But the story that's coming out of the characters doesn't lose momentum. Right?
Right.
That's two different things. So I could actually see this film being better on a second viewing. But that is true. I was aware that the mystery, the caper, kind of lost its luster. And that in part is because the caper itself is no longer, by the midway point, coming out of them. It's these two detectives who cross paths and finally work together. But still, exploring what they learn about themselves through the process of working together is nevertheless quite entertaining.
Well, I'm dying to see it only because it has the shots of L.A. that I like and in the trailer. And being over in Sydney, as much as I enjoy it here, I do miss walking through downtown L.A. every day.
It is fun also, Dean, seeing not only 70s recreated, but there is a degree to which this film feels like it was made the way you would have made a movie in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Authenticating that film stock and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, and also just the way they shot the scenes and practical locations and the kind of lighting and the kind of camera movement. Not exactly. I mean, it's not... You're not going to mistake this for something that fell out of a film vault.
Right.
I think that's a really bold way to make a movie. But still, even Shane Black talks about it. It was such a restorative after directing his biggest hit, Iron Man 3, because he said, you know, you do a movie like that, nobody's allowed to direct it. It's these teams of technicians that are creating it in advance and then creating it in post. And here, you know, you're only using technology like CGI and After Effects and things like this to enhance what you've been shooting on the set.
Right. And to give it this 70s look, I'm sure that requires a team of filters, Instagram filter type things to make it look like that.
Although, you know, when Nicholson shot The Two Jakes, now, of course, this is 26 years ago now, so this is a period piece itself, a period piece of a period piece. But when they shot that, you know, they already by the late 90s, you know, the smog, well, late 80s, of course, we're talking about the smog in the 70s. So, of course, in the late 80s, there'd be lots and lots of smog. But but they didn't have the CGI technology, really, and color correction wasn't digital yet. So you didn't really have the ability then to remove the smog for a film set in the late 40s. Right? So
yeah,
they had to design lenses that did that for them when they shot. Isn't that cool?
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing stuff used to get done in camera, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I caught up on two horror films that I'd... one recent vintage that I'd wanted to see and one a classic vintage that I'd never seen for some strange reason. And the classic one was Brian De Palma's Carrie. I'd never seen that film.
Oh, me neither. This is Brian De Palma's third film, I think. This is after Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes,
actually.
Indeed. Many of the same personnel, including production designer. A production designer who did Phantom of the Paradise, and that production designer would play a very important role in Carrie because he would be the one that finally talked De Palma into giving Sissy Spacek an audition because De Palma wanted other actresses, and he was so blown away by her that she got the part. So he owes that production designer a great debt of thanks. Certainly she owes that production designer a great debt of thanks, and I'm sure she was able to thank him for it when they went home at night because they were married.
I did know that.
Yeah, isn't that funny? So De Palma's production designer was married to Sissy Spacek. Anyway, the acting in this is so fantastic. Sissy Spacek rightfully got an Oscar nomination and launched her career for it. And of course, Piper Laurie had a huge comeback playing her mother and also got an Oscar nomination. But throughout this cast, the young cast of people, some who would become hot for maybe a cup of coffee, like William Catt and PJ Souls. William Catt would be the greatest American hero. But how about Travolta's first big film role? How about Nancy Allen, who was giving up on show business until De Palma talked her into coming back? And she would become a big star of the 80s, right? Going on not only to star in several of his own films and become his wife, but the RoboCop movies. So, you know, so much of the success of this, the film is dated in some ways, but it still works. And one of the reasons it really still works is it's a great cast making you believe these characters.
Wow. Oh, you know what? I got to see this again because, you know, I think this movie scared the crap out of me just in the trailers and the couple of times I saw it on TV. So I never really embraced it for its movie making. I was always freaked out by just its plot itself. So I think now I'm at an age where I can look past the actual fear and enjoy the making of the film, one would hope.
There's some really interesting work being done. Anyway, the recent horror film that it killed me, I did not see in theaters, is The Witch. And this is the first film from, I think Robert Eggers is the filmmaker's name, and he is already so accomplished, Dean. And this I alluded to when talking about The Nice Guys, because here's a film that gets unparalleled great reviews for a horror film and at film festivals. And it comes out and it does better than expected upon its initial release that opening weekend, largely because of how great the reviews are, right? And how effective the trailer is. But then the box office drops off. And even though at $1 million budget, the film ends up making $38 million theatrical around the world. That's a hell of a healthy return. The audience score for this movie was a C minus.
What?
And if you look at what the comments are on this, they are hateful. And it brings up two topics worthy of discussion. One that is in our wheelhouse that we've discussed many times. This trailer was so effective, but it promised a movie different than the one that was delivered. Right? So it got them a lot of box office, so it didn't teach them a lesson, but is it possible they left box office on the table because of the bad word of mouth from audience members that got an art film when they expected the latest chapter of the Insidious series?
See?
Don't kid yourself. The film is scary, but it is... And I won't say it's slow because, I mean, the movie's only like 90 minutes long, but it's not rapid-paced shock value the way that some of these modern franchises are built, especially when they're religiously themed. This one builds a slow dread and horror that it doesn't start to fully express until a little bit later on in the film. And it's a movie I love. It's set in, you know, Salem, old, colonies, it's a very devout religious family that are cast out by their colony because they're too religious. Puritans being cast out of a Puritan colony because they're too religious. They are on their high horse telling the community that they are not religious enough. The powers that be in that community don't like it, so they banish them. And what this film is about is very fascinating. It's about the danger of repression. But specifically, what an interesting thing that religious repression creates. Because the religious repression is inspired by what? A fear of sin. So they repress all this. But a repression of sin always leads to the manifestation of evil.
Right, because it's, as you say, foregoing your shadow will always come back.
So what an interesting kind of method of control the Bible biz came up with, right? We can get people to fear this so much that they'll repress it, which will manifest it, which will lead them right back to us.
Isn't that something? Wow, that's a good one. And this movie's called The Witch.
The Witch, yes. Now the
and everybody's hating it because they've been duped by the marketing team.
Well, that's one possibility. The other possibility, and this came through in a couple of reviews. I found one review where the critic actually said, don't be distracted by the fact that 90% of the people you're seeing this with will be too stupid to understand the movie they're watching.
Oh.
A critic actually said that. Okay. But here is, there's another critic who wasn't so derisive about people. But what he said was, and I thought this was really interesting, for the most part, especially when it comes to horror films, the people who are going, the people who are voting, the people who are commenting online, these are young people. And he wrote a very interesting analysis that this is just the latest example of an entire generation rejecting cinema as an art form.
Wow. This also precludes why box office is at its lowest rate and that the millennials aren't coming to the movies anymore.
Well, or that there's absolutely no, what would you call it, correlation between how good a movie is and how it does with the millennials at all.
Right.
It is about whether or not it appeals to what they want from movies. And there is no sense on the part of the young folks that they need to learn about this tradition, this lineage, to be informed about it. They want what they want, and they want it now. And if they don't get it, there's plenty of other avenues to get those dopamine levels raised.
Yeah, you got your YouTube, your video games, streaming everything, all of that. But yeah, I could see that being a problem in the future too. As storytelling breaks down? I don't think storytelling is breaking down. I guess cinematic language is breaking down.
Yeah, and the as I've said, the cinematic literacy is breaking down. Absolutely. On the part, sadly, now not only of the audience, but on the filmmakers themselves, and as we've known, of the studio executives for some time. Right? When corporations came in and took over, and yet MBAs running everything, whatever anyone would have said about the old studio system, the people that ran it were show people. They were storytellers.
Absolutely. And there was none of this business models of risk aversion or risk management and how to mitigate losses over profit over, you know, that sort of thing. All of those things you learn at Harvard Business School applying to the art of filmmaking doesn't really mesh together. And when you do start applying that, then you come up with words like product locomotive, and you have a bunch of superhero movies that in Star Wars that comes out every year, good or bad.
Hey, we referenced in this, and I can't wait. We really do need to plan to do a special theme show where we talk about our favorite all-time horror films. We've never done this, and
no.
And I would find that fascinating. So let's make a plan for that. I'm sure. I mean, your list will undoubtedly turn me on to movies that I need to see, because I would say that this, you know, with the obvious outlier of the silent films, is the genre in which I'm probably least familiar.
Right.
So, but I wanted to get back to something when I was talking about my road trip last week, and I had hinted at the fact that I'm really kind of falling in love with the South. And that's not just because I had my first Cracker Barrel experience, but don't kid yourself. There's no better introduction. But, you know, I loved Knoxville, Tennessee. This is an amazing city on a river, and its downtown is historic and thriving. And, of course, there's the University of Tennessee is in the heart of it. And then you go to Nashville, which is a fascinating city, right? You've got show business. You've got the music industry. But it's also known as the belt buckle on the Bible Belt, because that's where Bible printing, all of the printing business, was based in Nashville. So imagine that, Bible printing and show business centered there. What an interesting combination. And then you have no less than two major universities, again, within walking distance in the city limits. So it's a university town. I mean, that's a rich brew for a city. So, of course, I loved those things. But I got to have a wonderful morning with Cameron Tilbury, the country music entrepreneur who is a regular contributor to the Midweek Drive in the UK, Alex Lefchuk's program for Siren FM that I enjoy. And I had such a great talk with him. You know, he is an expat Canadian who's become an American citizen and has always loved the South and has always been a cowboy at heart. And, you know, we go to breakfast and he's got two guns strapped on him. And, you know, and he's telling me about how, because I asked him, you know, as an outsider, you want to be a little conservative about asking questions like this. But I said, is it possible that the Civil War is still going on? Right. And he said, of course it is. Of course it is. And you get down there and you realize that it is, and that it, and you suddenly understand why, you know, them not being huge fans of Lincoln is not necessarily a matter of racism.
And abolition?
You know, that it's that it has to do with the fact that the Civil War was not primarily for the South, nor initially even for the North, about emancipation of slaves, right? It was a war over federal authority versus states' rights.
Yeah.
And that battle is still waging. And it was a battle that had to simmer for a long time because of slavery and then Reconstruction, emancipation and Reconstruction. But then you also have, the telltale signs of the lingering animosity towards Lincoln being because of how much he sought to punish the South.
The
vendetta. I
didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, this is not stuff as a boy in California I grew up reading, and I'm somewhat of a student of the Civil War and of American history. So I love this. I love immersing myself in not only learning a different perspective on history, but a perspective that is still informing what's going on right now. The other thing that's so refreshing is, of course, I've never been exactly what one would think of as a good old boy or, a cowboy or any of these sort of things. But, what is so refreshing, and it's apropos of the conversation about repression we were having earlier about the witch and religion and a conversation that will continue a couple weeks with our guest, Dave Pickering, to whom we alluded.
That's right.
But when you're down in the South, you know where you stand with people.
Oh.
You really know where you stand. And
what do you mean?
I mean, there's not a lot of bullshit. If they don't like you, they don't agree with you, whatever, they let you know.
Yes.
And I was curious in describing that if you had any sense of that when you've performed in the South.
It was always my favorite story about the Marx Brothers, how they had three different prints of their films because they toured extensively. They knew that the West Coast and the East Coast had different senses of humor, and the South had its own sense of humor. And so you would edit your movies because you knew which jokes would get longer laughs in which parts of the country. And the South, I loved performing there. Because the laughter was loud and immediate for bits they loved. And even though there's a sense of generosity, so that even bits that weren't that funny, there would still be an appreciation in laughter. But in terms of heckling, I mean, other than getting, it was El Paso, Texas, where I was bitten by an audience member. So, yeah, they do let you know where they stand immediately. Of course, when I was trying to take her cell phone to do a comedy bit, she just bit me in the wrist and promptly left. But, that's the price you pay for doing improv. I don't know if I should encourage that or not. But yeah, I think I agree with you that there was an immediateness to the reaction and not a thinking, how shall I put that, a gate in which the jokes went through before a response was heard.
One of the other highlights of the trip was visiting Dallas, visiting our friend Pete Asplund, who's involved in the making of Truth Is Out There Too, and really availing myself, creating my own Lee Harvey Oswald tour. I really enjoyed hunkering down in the window at the Book Depository just to feel what it was like to have someone in my scope. No, I didn't do that. But I did go to Dealey Plaza, of course, and I was staying across the street from the Texas Theater, and it's fascinating at the Book Depository. I know you've been there. On the historic marker, we've never talked about this, on the historic marker, it actually says this is the building where Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot the president. The word allegedly is in there, and, there's a lot of people that go over the wording on these historic markers. I guess, of course, you have to use allegedly. The man was never put on trial, right?
Right.
So you wouldn't be able to say he did it. It was never proved in a court of law. Although I would have thought that the Warren Commission was some kind of finding of fact. But allegedly is amazing. But why you zero in on that word is that long ago someone scratched a circle around the word allegedly.
Exactly. And it's like... every year, I think it seems to be scratched deeper in. as somebody goes, yeah, allegedly, look at that.
So I asked Pete, though, I said, like, why is there no Lee Harvey Oswald tour here in Dallas? Like, wouldn't that be a moneymaker? Take the Lee Harvey Oswald tour, tour all the important sites and everything. And,
yeah.
Well, I guess one of the reasons is that, and this reflects how long I've been living in L.A., that would really be in poor taste making money off that.
Oh, really? So when I was there in the 90s, what was there but a opened Cadillac limo ride in the exact same car Kennedy was shot in, taking the exact same route? So it had JFK Tours written on the side, a big silver caddy open air, and driving around Dealey Plaza with tourists in there.
That was, how is, that was yeah, that was in poor taste.
Well,
so the other reason, though, that Pete pointed out that you can't do a Lee Harvey Oswald tour is that tour would immediately point out the inaccuracies and inconsistencies in the timeline.
Yeah. In fact, if you noticed at the top floor of the book depository, they sealed off the stairway because I think people were trying to run from that stairway to the movie theater in 2 minutes and 13 seconds. Which was
or
the
whatever
time
it
the
is,
shoot.
Yeah, it wasn't 2 minutes seconds, but yeah, it's a long drive there.
Yeah,
you know, it would have taken him more than an hour the way that they said. So anyway, you would learn these things, you'd realize these things, and that opens a can of worms that nobody wants reopened again,
yeah.
And again and again. Of course, my road trip, Dean, was made possible by the 100% pure gas. Found only at Empire State Gas. Professional drivers enjoy stopping by for the hot showers and the sparkling restrooms, but now all travelers can hurry on over to their refreshment center for the most extravagant array of refreshment goodies ever assembled under one roof. Enjoy breathtaking, mouth-watering goodies, everything from a snack to a delicious full meal. Empire State Gas and ESG Cafe, eat food, get gas.
Fantastic.
That brings us to the end of another exciting installment.
Aww.
We haven't even talked about my trip to White Sands or my trip to Canyon de Chelly, where the Anasazi mysteriously disappeared more than
absolutely.
You know,
and I forgot to mention, I just been certified as a scuba diver this weekend.
I know you did because Lily came over and showed me a photo of Patty Paquette's certificate. So that'll have to be talked about. And we have a great email from a listener whose son wants to know what our favorite toys were when we were his age. So we will get to all that.
That's a fantastic question.
And so much more on next week's show. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. You can download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review, even if you don't have anything else to do.
Who could possibly have anything else to do? Write us as these people have. ChillPackHollywood at yahoo.com. C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood at yahoo.com.
Follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil. Write out the word and.
Oh, Dean Haglund, you may not be aware of this. We're on Instagram at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. You don't care?
Yeah, no, I didn't know we're on Instagram.
I know, I told you didn't know we were on Instagram. Your head is like, now I just gave you another concussion or at least whiplash.
I know, I'm blown away. Fantastic, okay, so.
All right, yeah. Well, that's the end of another exciting installment. Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Hagley, we'll see you then. It's your two-pack Hollywood Hour. 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 It's your two-continental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.